Corn production in the U.S. has surged since 2007 when Congress required oil companies to mix more ethanol into their gasoline as a way of reducing greenhouse gases. But increased corn production has come with some major environmental costs. More than 5 million acres set aside for conservation, that's more than the Yellowstone, Everglades, and Yosemite National Parks combined, have vanished, while nearly 19 million acres of corn have been planted. We're joined now by Associated Press reporters Matt Apuzzo and Dina Capiello. They contributed to an AP investigation into corn-based ethanol production. I'm very pleased to welcome them to our show. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Has most of the increase in corn production been just in the Midwest?
Yeah, the bulk of, obviously this is a story about the heartland. Not only are you seeing more corn in traditional corn places like Iowa, where we traveled for the story, but you're also seeing an expansion of the so-called Corn Belt northward, not only because of a mandate like ethanol, but because of seed genetics and farming practices. So much of this takes place in the middle of the country.
Matt, can you describe what that part of the country looks like now? Didn't you do an analysis using satellite imagery? What does it look like from space?
Yeah, so the reason we had to use satellite imagery is because the government has actually made it almost impossible to really nail down the kind of land conversion we're trying to get at, which is, and the question, of course, is, so when you mandate the oil companies to add a bunch of ethanol to the gasoline, do farmers respond by plowing into new land? And when you plow into new land, it actually releases carbon, carbon dioxide that's been locked up in the soil and the roots. So it's really important for the policy to work that farmers not do that. But when they set out to do this policy, the government didn't actually put in a mechanism to monitor whether that's happening. What they did is they said, well, we'll look and see if the overall crop acreage in the country changes, and it hasn't really. And the problem with that is every time somebody paves over a farm in New Jersey to build a Walmart, it masks what's going on in the Midwest. So we use satellite imagery, and we were able to look at snapshots of the Earth, the Midwest, in 2006, the year before the ethanol mandate was passed, in 2012. And what we were able to find is that conservatively 1.2 million acres of grassland, that's a combination of virgin prairie land and pasture land, has been plowed over since then. So it's what Dean is talking about, the expansion of the Corn Belt to meet the demands of an expanding population, its world population, and ethanol.
And Dina, ethanol was touted in the mid-2000s as a solution to our dependence on foreign oil and a way to curb global warming. What made corn-based ethanol seem so promising?
Well, obviously, when this was passed, it was kind of like a different world, right? Oil prices were really high. We are getting a lot of it from foreign countries. Just yesterday, it was announced that for the first time since like the mid-90s, we are now actually producing more oil in the U.S. than we are importing. And we're also actually, driving less and using less gasoline because of fuel efficiency standards.
But yet oil prices are still in our area somewhere between $3.50 and $4 a gallon.
And obviously this, so what they would say is, look, they wanted more homegrown energy, which obviously this is homegrown energy, is being grown on U.S. soil. And on the greenhouse gas perspective, there was a lot of recognition back then of obviously oil's impact, which is still there. And they thought that ethanol was going to be better. And what our story talks about is that it really may not be, and it's probably not right now. It may be come 2022, when the law said that it had to be 20% better than petroleum gasoline. But a lot of research shows that right now it's kind of questionable whether actually it is better because, as you're plowing into these lands, this is a pretty intensive farming. People are row cropping and tilling. You're using more gasoline. They're breaking onto marginal lands, which requires more fertilizer. Fertilizer releases greenhouse gases. There's the nitrous oxide that's released. That's much more powerful than carbon dioxide. And then you're talking about the refining process. This is an industrial facility, ethanol plants, and a lot of them use natural gas. Some of them use coal. And then you can't put it in a pipeline. You got to truck it. So you burn gasoline there. So, again, I think that when you start looking at the life cycle impacts, I think what our reporting showed is that A, the science is kind of squishy, and you really can't prove whether it's better from a greenhouse gas perspective either.
Aren't coal plants and oil plants that oil using plants that use ethanol exempted from the greenhouse gas legislation?
Yeah, so that's the other thing that happened. I mean, is that when they wrote the rules to implement this law, which, as you know, was passed under President Bush, they exempted all existing plants. So as we point out in the piece, you know, this 20% goal was really about marketing, was about an industry talking about how clean and how green it was. And so the significance when the EPA first came out and said, hey, we don't think that ethanol is going to quite get to 20% come 2022, it's only 16%, really wasn't about, you know, enforcing that number. It was about the image of that industry.
Now, Matt, I get the sense that there's been a lot of fiddling with the numbers by the Obama administration. Have environmental groups and scientists been skeptical in how the administration's determined the carbon emissions of corn-based ethanol?
They have, and it's interesting because it speaks to the politics of what's going on here. You know, we talked to scientists, and we talked to experts in the Obama administration, and who were, you know, some of the key people, even on the transition team, when Obama came into office, and they were telling us, look, we didn't have any real great enthusiasm for this program from the get-go. So you had sort of two competing interests. You had the interest of Obama as a environmental guy talking about climate change and, you know, making that a priority, competing at the same time with Obama's longstanding support for biofuels coming from Illinois, the number two producer of corn in the country. And, you know, he was a big supporter of corn-based ethanol, and his Secretary of Agriculture, Vilsack, is a huge supporter of ethanol. So there's tension there. There's competing tension. When you talk to people at EPA, they feel very strongly one way, and when you talk to people at USDA, they feel very strongly another way. And it just shows you that, you know, as Dina talked about, you know, the science of that this is a net positive, it's just squishy.
Now, Dina, why has the emphasis been on corn-based ethanol as national policy? Can't you make it from a range of other plants in Brazil? They make it from sugar cane, don't they?
You can make it from a range of other plants, but unfortunately in this country, the so-called cellulosics, which actually are the waste products, hasn't really taken off. And I think there's also been a vested interest in, you know, helping middle America and creating a new market for corn. I mean, obviously, I mean, one of the positives of this policy has been, you know, a boon to rural America. You talk to farmers, and the farmers we talk to, yeah, of course, they're torn. They know the consequences of converting marginal land from the environmental perspective. But they also kind of want to keep farming, and they want to keep that farm in the family. And by passing a mandate like this, it created a whole new place for corn to go. And as I think, you know, it's not lost on anyone, these are some very powerful interests. So you talk about, you know, the ethanol industry, which is doing well because of this mandate and needs this mandate to keep on going, or the corn growing folks who want to see it kept and kept robust.
Although it has driven up prices for just the corn that we eat, the corn that's fed to other animals, so perhaps that's even made it more attractive to farmers.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's really the price, right? It's the price that's driving the conversion. And obviously you can't peg that price increase solely on ethanol. But ethanol is what's really increased in terms of where the corn crop is going since this mandate came to be. I mean, you talk about, you know, the industry likes to talk about, you know, demand from abroad, but our exports haven't gone through the roof since this mandate came to be. Livestock feed really hasn't changed much in terms of where we put our corn. One thing that's changed is ethanol, and it's those prices that make it, you know, make it a good financial equation for farmers to break into marginal lands when they know they're going to have to spend money on the fertilizers, when they know they're going to have to spend money on big equipment to till it and to take these grasses out of the land to plant corn. I mean, there's an expense to that, and it only makes sense when you have high corn prices. It's also an expense, you know. The Obama administration didn't predict this would happen. The Department of Energy said, no way, farmers aren't going to plant on marginal lands. EPA said it was uncertain. Well, that's exactly what's happening.
I'm talking with Dina Capiello and Matt Apuzzo of the Associated Press about the impact of ethanol on our economy and on the environment. Matt, Dina mentioned fertilizer. Doesn't corn require large amounts of fertilizer? What is the impact of fertilizer on the land that the corn is being produced on?
Yeah, it's a great question, and you're right. Corn requires some of the highest levels of so-called inputs of any crop, and so what happens is you have seen an increase of at least 1 billion pounds. They only update the hard numbers every 5 years, but probably 2 billion pounds of corn. Of fertilizer are used for corn, and so what you're having is that concentration is happening in the Midwest. And so one of the examples we came across was the Des Moines Water Works, for instance. They had to keep their nitrogen removal facility running basically around the clock all summer, and had to ask people to not water their lawns or not use so much water, not because they had a water shortage, they had plenty of water, but to keep up, just to keep the water at a safe level, to get those nitrates out of the water supply.
Because ethanol production has been connected to the dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico?
Right, and so what happens is that the more row cropping you do and the more fertilizer that goes into the watershed, that filters down, it sort of flows down our nation's rivers, and it dumps out into the Gulf. And scientists down in Texas are saying, look, you can track ethanol, and you can track increase in corn production for ethanol to expansion of this dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, where nothing can survive, where fishermen don't find fish anymore.
Isn't the production of these fertilizers dependent on petroleum? Is that one of the ironies of this story?
There's a lot of ironies in the story, but that is indeed one of them. Yes, I mean these fertilizers are come from natural gas, and so a simplistic way to say it is you need petroleum to produce ethanol. To then blend it with petroleum and burn it in a gasoline tank. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of ironies in this story.
And then the federal government, which is promoting this, has to pay for the environmental cleanups.
Right.
That's a really good point, is that, yeah, there's kind of programs working against each other, right? I mean, and this is what Larry McKinney down in Texas said. He's like, here we are as a government trying to solve this dead zone problem, but we have this other policy that's feeding the problem. And whether you look in the Dakotas where prairies are being plowed over, you have this policy that's driving that's helping to drive that conversion, and then you have another arm of the government, the Interior Department, putting, money into conservation easements to kind of stem and to kind of halt the conversion. And so it's kind of like policies working against each other.
Well, what is the impact of farmers plowing virgin land?
Well, one of the things that happens, as I sort of alluded to earlier, is everybody knows about photosynthesis, right? I mean, the grass takes the carbon dioxide out of the air and turns it into oxygen, that whole thing. But also soil and grass, they sort of lock in carbon. And so when you plow into it, that actually gets sort of like a giant burp. The field just burps up the carbon into the air. Some scientists say, it can take decades to work all that back out of the air. And I think what we're getting at, and it's irony is certainly a word, but I think what we're looking at here is that all energy comes with a cost. And we all know how bad petroleum products and drilling for oil, and we all know the environmental costs associated with coal and oil and natural gas. But the government sort of moves the goalposts when they talk about clean energy, when they talk about ethanol in particular. This was pitched as an environmental product, but now when you hear them talk about it, they almost never mention ethanol. And you hear Vilsack is talking about it, this is about jobs in the Midwest. And jobs in the Midwest are important, but it's important that we tell people that what was sold as a green energy product is now being sold to us as this is jobs in the Midwest, this is about farm income, this is about stabilizing the economy in rural America, which, again, are all important things, but it is a different sales pitch than what we had 6 years ago.
Because, as you point out, you mentioned earlier, the EPA determined fairly early on that that corn ethanol was only slightly better than gasoline when it came to carbon dioxide emissions. Just a few percentage points. What about pesticides? Aren't we using more pesticides to build this to grow this kind of corn? Dina?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, as Matt said, I mean, corn is a high input crop. It's probably the most intensive crop in terms of inputs, and you're going to have to use pesticides too. And you know, we went to in southern Iowa, a lake there by the name of Rathbun Lake historically had problems with atrazine and some of these pesticides, and are continuing to worry about that because they're seeing, you know, in their watershed, and that's a huge, it's one of the largest rural water supplies in the country, they are seeing the conversion of this land. And what's kind of crazy about it, right, is that, you know, the USDA does have these programs that encourage farmers when they do turn over a field to do conservation practices to kind of stem the soil erosion and to make sure that soil and these pesticides and these fertilizers aren't running into waterways. But this little, you know, lake association, you know, in very rural southern Iowa is actually going and trying to convince landowners themselves, because some of them don't want to do it because, you know, some of these conservation measures, when it's a waterway or it's leaving some land kind of a natural state to filter out the sediment, that's land that's not planted with corn. And so it's a battle.
Can't the case be made that ethanol, while not great for the environment, may be better than fracking or tar sands production?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think that one thing that the industry would say, and I think it's actually a valid point, is that when EPA did this comparison that was required by law, it used a 2005 petroleum baseline, right? Now it's we're in 2013, right? We're talking about building the Keystone XL oil pipeline to bring in, you know, tar sands from Canada, a very energy intensive process to actually make them even into an oil that can flow down a pipeline. And not to mention their carbon footprint. And we're also talking about fracking, and there's environmental dangers associated with that as well. And so they would say, hey, EPA, go back to the drawing board. Let's look at this again. Let's do a new comparison. And the response by the EPA to us and actually to the industry is, hey, we don't have the money or the manpower to do that. And, you know, in addition, one thing we pointed out in the story as well is, you know, although this law required all of these environmental safeguards, not only are they not really tracking the land conversion in a way that actually shows the extent of the problems, but they were also required to do air and water quality studies, which they haven't even done.
Matt, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, you spoke earlier about this idea of, well, can't we get it from other sources? Can we get our energy from other sources?
And wasn't corn-based ethanol supposed to be a temporary fuel?
Exactly. So, and that's exactly the point. So corn-based ethanol was supposed to be this sort of bridge to the next generation. That we were never going to get cleaner, cheaper, non-food-based biofuels if the government didn't create and then prop up a corn-based ethanol, a biofuels market, for a few years. But the problem is that they've propped up and they've created this market, and the cellulosic biofuel market has completely failed to live up to expectations. I mean, we're talking about just a few drips in comparison to, you know, what's actually in the pipeline from other ethanol sources. And so as long as cellulosics aren't there, the problems that the government was willing to accept with corn ethanol sort of get exacerbated because that bridge gets longer and longer and longer, and you hope that it's a bridge to somewhere, right? You know, they were writing stories about how cellulosic ethanol, these next generation cleaner fuels, were just around the corner in the 20s. I mean, this has been the panacea for a long time. I mean, it would really be a breakthrough, and hopefully the administration hopes would make all of the investment in corn ethanol worthwhile.
Well, we have 10 seconds left. Are we stuck with this for quite a while?
It looks like that. I mean, obviously, any day now, maybe as soon as tomorrow, the EPA is going to lower how much corn ethanol will be blended into gasoline.
To leave it there, unfortunately. Yep. Thank you both so much, Dina Capiello and Matt Apuzzo of the Associated Press.